Spirit Radio Podcasts. The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
It's a little under 2 weeks since Pope Francis returned from his historic trip visiting Iraq. He was the first pope ever to visit Iraq. One journalist that was on the papal plane and on this trip with Pope Francis was Irish journalist Colm Flynn, who also reports for EWTN. And we talked a little bit about the trip and its significance and some of the highlights. But the first thing Colm talked about was just the pressure that Pope Francis was under to get the message right and what sort of a job he did at doing that.
Yeah, you're right, Wendy. It was there was pressure for a lot of different reasons. One, because of course, COVID-19 and the pandemic, and cases of COVID-19 were just beginning to soar in Iraq. And then all of a sudden you had this papal trip. Now, in most places, there were not large crowds gathering because of the security. But on the final day of the trip, in a stadium in the city of Erbil, 10,000 people came together to celebrate Mass. So that was a concern in terms of COVID, but I'll get back to that in a minute. But then the other big thing was security. There were rocket attacks in Iraq just 2 days before the Pope was due to land. There were suicide bombings back in January in Baghdad, where we were staying. So people were wondering, and I think rightly so, if the Iraqi forces and government and the authorities couldn't guarantee safety within their own borders and keep things under control, how are they going to pull off security as comprehensive and as complex as something like a papal visit? The security was something like I have never seen before. And even one Iraqi man that I met, he said to me that he had never seen so much military since the war in Iraq. Everywhere we went, Wendy, we had a massive convoy of Iraqi Secret Service, Iraqi military, police.
I think you were wearing your bulletproof vest. You were wearing a bulletproof vest the whole time.
I didn't actually wear it. We brought it. The U.S. Army, we met the U.S. Army beforehand because some of them are based here in Rome to give us kind of a consult about the security. And they advised all of us to go and get bulletproof vests. So the TV network forked out a fortune on these bulletproof vests for me and the crew. Thankfully, we didn't have to wear them. But I mean, that's the kind of setting you're going into, Wendy, with people with machine guns everywhere. Sniffer dogs for bombs, bulletproof vests. And even in the morning, every morning we would get on a small bus, all the journalists, and we would be taken to the church we were going to see the Pope at or to the airport for an internal flight. And just before the bus leaves the hotel, an Iraqi Secret Service man would come on and he would say, I remember this is like 6 a.m. He'd said, look around, look at everyone around you. Is there anybody on this bus you do not recognize? And that sets the tone for the day because, you know, you have lighthearted fun with the journalist friends, but then you keep having to remind yourself this is quite a serious place we are and it could be dangerous. But thankfully, everything went really smoothly and there were no incidents.
It sounds like it was so well organized. So tell us a little bit, Colm, about some of the key places that the Pope visited and who he met with.
The biggest meeting of all was not at the presidential palace and nowhere where they had splendor and grandeur. He went to a lot of those places. And I know before this, we talked about before the trip, was this a political trip or was it a pilgrimage? Was it for Christians? You know, these papal journeys are always a mix of a lot of things. And yes, there was a lot of shaking hands with politicians and the prime minister. He went and met the president of Kurdistan as well, which is an autonomous region in the north of Iraq. He met 150 Iraqi government officials in the palace on the first day. So there was a lot of that. But the biggest meeting for the Holy Father, for Pope Francis, was away from all the glitter and the jewels and the palace. It was down this small, dilapidated alleyway in the holy city of Najaf, because it was down there he went to the home of a man who was called the Grand Ayatollah or the Grand Master, and his name was Ali al-Sistani. He is seen as the spiritual leader of most of the Muslim community in the country. So he has never met someone like Pope Francis and someone at that level in the Muslim world. They've never had a meeting like this before. And we were told that when Pope Francis went into his home, he stood up to greet Pope Francis. And this is the first time he had ever done this. So the symbolism of this was just huge.
It really set the tone for that interfaith dialogue to begin.
Yeah, and when we were in the press room, they had screens with all the kind of world media. You had like the Western channels, CNN and NBC, but they had also the Arabic channels. And as soon as Pope Francis went in to meet this Grand Ayatollah, it was wall to wall across all of the Arabic-speaking world channels, all across CNN. It was just such an incredible moment. Now, it was a private meeting for 45 minutes, so we don't know for sure what they really talked about. But afterwards, we were told by the Holy See Press Office that he agreed with Pope Francis that Christians who've been persecuted for years in Iraq should be able to live in peace, and furthermore, should have the same rights as all other citizens. So if most Muslims in the country are taking their cues from this man, you have to hope that it is going to have a real long-lasting positive effect.
And that's the thing, is what is going to be the effect? What do you think that this visit meant to people around the world, especially for persecuted Christians in Iraq?
That's the million-dollar question, Wendy. What will the long-term effects be? And I suppose the quick and simple answer is time will tell. But what I can tell you, I remember I was only there for 3 days. So having been there for 3 days and conscious that we were on a very carefully stage-managed tour, a papal trip like this, you're brought to the beautiful places, you're brought to these significant places, and the people you meet are very much hand-selected. Most of the Iraqi people I met my own age were well-educated. They were from Baghdad, the capital. We didn't get a chance to go out to rural Iraq or the smaller villages and, you know, kind of get a sense of the real people. But the people that we met there, the one thing I can tell you in the short term is this brought a shot of such joy and happiness to them. They kept sending me messages on social media because they would see our posts saying thank you so much to the media for covering Iraq in a way that they had never seen Iraq covered before. Because when I went over, all I thought about when I thought of Iraq was war, destruction, devastation, a barbaric country. That's what I thought I was getting into. The people could not have been warmer. They could not have been kinder. And I think for them, despite the COVID concerns when they were all packed together in that stadium, it was worth the risk. This moment of healing, this moment of joy and happiness and pride at them being able to show the world their hospitality for the Pope, I think that meant the world to them.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Community Connect is a wonderful initiative that provides practical supports for new mums. And today is a big day for them, because what they're asking for you to do today, anytime from 1 o'clock today, the 20th of March, is to leave out on your doorstep in a clear waterproof bag some essential items. So new items, things like baby wipes, nappy cream, practical stuff that new mums need. I recently chatted to Elaine Noonan, who's the manager of Community Connect. And you can check out, by the way, communityconnect.ie to see the collection points in your area. And she told me a little bit more about the collection day today, but she also just explained the main items that mums are seeking at this time.
To be honest, at the moment with the lockdown, clothes is the big one actually for a lot of mums and a lot of parents. A lot of the lower cost clothes are not accessible because many of the shops are closed. And some people are just, they're not in a position maybe to order things online, or in fact can't afford to order from the shops that are selling online. So we find a lot of people are looking for clothes at the moment.
Yeah, so it's just practical stuff. And what's some of the kind of good news responses that you've had, and that from mums that have gotten in touch that you've been able to support?
Well, we get so much lovely feedback, Wendy, from many of the parents we help. We often get mums telling us that they just didn't know where to turn, and that we've really taken the pressure off them and taken away the anxiety of having a new baby. And in some cases, we were there when they didn't have anyone else to turn to. And many of them do say they would love to pay it forward, and when they get on their feet, donate back to us so that we can help another family the way we help them. And it's lovely, really, to hear that. So, I mean, one example lately was we had a mother expecting her fifth baby and who had recently just moved out of homelessness and just needed clothes and baby items for the new baby. We had a 21-year-old who was pregnant and again had moved out of home and just needed the essentials really for her new baby, like things for her hospital bag, clothes, nappies, blankets, those kind of things. And then we have a lot of people who come to us through other agencies and other organisations. So we had a situation recently where one of the maternity hospitals contacted us about a lady who the family had just arrived in Ireland. They had no income of any kind, brand new baby, and then the public health nurse rang us one day and said, this lady doesn't even have nappies to put on her baby. So we rushed over and helped her with essentials, clothes, nappies and a buggy. But it's amazing the need that's out there. It really
is. And that's great that you've been able to respond to it because of people's generosity. And I guess the fact that the need is so great for some families and some mums, you have this upcoming National Donation Day. What's involved and how's it going to work, especially with COVID restrictions and all that sort of stuff, Lynn?
Yeah, so we had to be kind of creative about this, I think, Wendy, under the circumstances. So we had hoped to have drop-off locations, but obviously Level 5 made that impossible. So what we've done is we are asking people to pick up a few extra items in their weekly shop. So just things in the supermarket, nappies, wipes, baby wash, nappy cream, those kind of things, and leave them outside your door on Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 20th of March, from 1 o'clock, and our volunteers will go around and literally pick the bags up totally contact free from outside people's houses. So all people need to do is just register online to give us their address and location, and then leave the items out on Saturday, and they will be collected from outside your door or outside your gate.
All right, so there's a lot going on in terms of obviously you've got volunteers collecting all the stuff. How do people know, well, first of all, what should people be looking to donate and what sort of items do you need and the condition they need to be in? Just practical things like that, Elaine, you might tell us.
Yeah, sure. So we have a full list on our website, so people can have a look there. It's communityconnect.ie. But essentially, it's new items we're looking for on this occasion. We have a lot of pre-loved or used items that we do.
So you're
distribute.
Basically saying, do you know what? When you're going to do your weekly shop, grab an extra, you know, those 10 boxes of wipes, grab an extra one of those, something like that. Yeah.
Nappies, wipes, nappy cream, sponges, cotton wool, and then things like blankets, bibs, sleep suits, towels, those kind of things. And bits and pieces for mothers to bring to the maternity hospital as well, because we're often asked for items for hospital bags like dark towels, slippers, that type of thing.
So it's all just practical stuff. And how do people know? I presume it's all on the website as well in terms of where you're collecting from. Are you going to be collecting across the country?
We are. We have over 50 locations across the country, and we're just collecting within 5 kilometres of each of those areas that are listed because of the travel restrictions. But don't worry, if you're not in any of those areas, you can actually donate online as well on our website and sponsor a gift, and we will then prepare the gift on your behalf. So if you're outside of those locations, you can still get involved and contribute as well.
Well, it's such a great idea, and just it's such a simple thing. I think just have it on your radar before the 20th, pick up a few extra bits and bobs while you're in the supermarket anyway. What about for people, Elaine, who are just thinking, I'm outside one of the areas but I'd like to donate, can people just do that as well?
Exactly. Yeah, they can, Wendy. So they just go to our website, communityconnect.ie, and there's a link there, sponsor a gift, and you can just click there and you can see a list of all different combinations of gifts, nappies and wipes and baby grows and all sorts. And if people sponsor there, they can just do it with their card, the credit or debit card on our website. And we will then go and purchase the things on your behalf and give them to someone in need. And I would just appeal to everyone out there, if you can, it's just a small amount of money, but it goes a long way for someone in need. And we really have such demand at the moment. We would really love as much support as possible from people for this appeal at the moment. Would be great.
Elaine, thank you for all the work that you're doing with Community Connect, and hopefully you have a lot of great stuff left on people's doorsteps, and just fair play as well to all the volunteers who are going to be driving around collecting all that stuff. And I'm sure even that itself means a lot to mums that are in need, that there's so many people wanting to support and help them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Some of them can't believe how generous people are with their time and their energy, and of course with their, you know, their money as well, and giving the essential items to people. So thanks to all our volunteers and all our supporters. We're very grateful.
The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
For many of you listening, it might be difficult to think that we will once again face another year of not being able to attend our places of worship over the Easter period. Well, I chatted to columnist with the Sunday Times, David Quinn, about church closures, and he talked a little bit about how Ireland is an outlier compared to other European countries. Of course, you might have read recently that Catholic bishops have made their pleas really to government about reopening churches again. But David started off by touching on some of the other denominations that have also voiced their concerns about church closure.
In fact, there was a group also of independent Protestant pastors, you know, who have all these independent churches, often Pentecostal, often with large immigrant populations, and about 200 of them contacted the government, and they were pointing out, you know, we can do this safely, and we have been doing it safely during previous phases of this whole pandemic. And the reply they got from Micheál Martin was incredibly bland, was a kind of, you know, thank you for your letter. But none of the issues were addressed in it at all. And the issues were things like, you know, where's your evidence that it's risky to attend church when we were doing it under the same conditions as last summer? And through to, you know, October for some of the country. And there's just no response to that. And there's no response to, you know, why are we such an outlier in Europe in bringing a complete halt to public worship?
Talk to me about that. How are we an outlier if you compare us to other European countries?
Yeah, you see, I think probably your average churchgoer imagines that every country is doing what Ireland is doing, and there's only the reckless ones are not. But in fact, if you look around the EU, and there's websites where you can find this, official EU websites, and you can find restrictions by country. And as at a few days ago, there was only 3 out of 27 EU countries had brought a complete halt to public worship, and that was Slovenia, Slovakia, and us. But we're even more of an outlier, because no country has stopped public worship for longer than Ireland has. I think it's about 8 out of the last 12 months. I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary that we're facing into a second Easter where you won't be able to go to Mass or to any religious service. You can't even, as we know, go into a church, receive, you know, so you go in one door, receive communion, and go out the other door without congregating with anyone. And they even stopped that. We've had Gardaí visiting priests to put a halt to that. And all these measures are supported by the bishops, because they're trying to be as cooperative as possible with the public health authorities and the government. But they're extremely draconian. And as I say, they're extremely draconian by European and indeed world standards. And you have to ask, what's the justification of being so incredibly strict about it? I mean, each Sunday, I tune into a Mass, and lately I've been tuning into Masses in England because I want to tune into a Mass where I can see members of the public attending. And you see them, and there was one I tuned into in London yesterday, and at communion time, there was quite a number of people going up. Now, the way they had the churches worked, you know, the benches, you know, they had a tape across each second bench, so you couldn't go in, and people were properly socially distanced. But it's amazing to be able to tune into Mass in a country like England, where the so-called UK variant apparently originated, and they've allowed people to go to Mass all through this lockdown, because in the end, the public health authorities concluded there's no real risk to it. The risk is not proportionate or is not big enough to bring a complete halt to public worship, and so they didn't. And they had done that before, but didn't do it this time, because in the end they were looking at the evidence and they saw that the churches were doing it safely. Now, sometimes people say back to me on social media and so on, oh, here's this church and that church in South Korea or Berlin or America where there has been an outbreak. But they're few and far between. They're always where the church has not been observing the proper, you know, protocols around safety. And you see, a few isolated cases do not amount to a proportionate reason. The reason must always be proportionate as to why you do something. And then we've seen court cases in various countries. We've seen them in France. We've seen them, I think, in Switzerland. We've seen them in Belgium, Germany, where the courts have almost invariably said this ban on public worship is not justified by the evidence, and you must allow public worship again under the usual safety conditions.
And in terms, David, of our evidence here, and is there any backing up of, or NPHET or the government, are they saying, look, here's why churches are staying closed until at least level two? Is there any epidemiological evidence to show that they aren't safe places here in Ireland in particular?
Yeah, there's no direct evidence. I mean, I attended one of the NPHET press conferences back at the end of September. This is when Dublin was going back into level three. And so remember, it's not just under level five we can't go to church except for prayer. It's under level three and four as well. So it's amazing. So people might be thinking, oh, well, when level five, goes down to level four, we can go back. No, we can't, unless they adjust the levels. We can't go back until level two.
Which arguably could be another year.
Well, certainly well into the summer, because summer, I mean, there seems to be some seasonal aspect to COVID. So we were in level two, as we remember last summer, and the thing didn't spread, because again, there seems to be some seasonal thing going on. But certainly summer, and then right back in, unless the vaccination program is extremely successful. And you see, that's the worrying part. But anyway, this press conference, I asked for the evidence, and they basically said they didn't have any direct evidence. So what they tried to do is, and this is almost a direct quote from Ronan Glynn, the Deputy Chief Medical Officer, he said, well, in the context of a pandemic, we stop things considered less important. Now, I thought...
So that said it all really to you, David, did it?
Oh, big. Big time, because less important. Okay, so less important than keeping an off-licence open. And you see, remember again, under level three, you can go to a hairdresser, you can go to a gym on your own, you can go into any shop, so not just the food shops. So all this is permitted, and all that is considered, therefore, more important in the context of a pandemic than going to mass. Even though there is no constitutional right to go to your hairdresser, but there is a constitutional right to freedom of worship. And so the government and NPHET have really now relegated these to an extremely low priority, an afterthought at best. And again, I contrast with all these other countries, some of which are a lot more secular than we are, and they're permitting, again, with these limitations. And by the way, the limitations vary in a big way. In Belgium, 15 can attend mass, and it could be a vast cathedral. But in France, I think they allow attendance of up to about a quarter of capacity. But the church in Italy, I think it's around half. And by the way, most of Italy has just gone back into another lockdown, but they're not stopping mass.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
The Grammys took place last weekend, and Spirit Radio's very own Victoria Johnston was giving us the down low on everything that happened. But the amazing thing is, Victoria herself was shortlisted for a Grammy this year. So before she got into what happened at the Grammys this year, she shared with us her journey of being a Grammy nominee.
Yeah, it's been a very exciting few days and months leading up to the awards. So I was thankful to be able to stream it live from Dublin, from home, and join in the celebrations.
So tell us about how it works. When you are a musician like you and you're an artist, how are you told you've been shortlisted for a Grammy, and what happens in the journey next?
Yeah, so it's quite a long process. So, well, I released my debut singles back in March, and then I heard in June that they were being put forward in the consideration round. And it's a really lengthy process. So it was an eye opener even to just myself learning the process. So the process lasted from June until October, and I got through a few rounds of those stages. And then I found out at the end of October that I got through to the final shortlist round, which was incredible, because from that shortlist round, you've the five final nominees. So I was shortlisted alongside Taylor Swift, Billie Eilish, Dua Lipa, just amazing artists, Beyonce as well, which was just really just a great thrill for me, especially with my debut singles. It was quite unexpected, but I did feel there was something a little bit special about the song. So I'm really glad that they resonated with the Grammy panel as well, especially Tarlum, which is a song in Irish. So I was kind of extra proud of that one being in the Irish language, that it was well received.
Yeah, and since then I've seen many an article, Victoria, you've been described as the next Enya. How do things like that feel, that level of recognition?
Yeah, well, it's a lovely compliment, but I always kind of say very big musical shoes to try and fill. But yeah, just lovely that people resonate with my music and are giving loads of compliments. And I've been really grateful to the Irish press and radio stations across the country who have picked up on the songs and the Grammy news. And it's been really encouraging for me as well. Just obviously, actually, I released the debut singles when Ireland went into lockdown. So there's been no opportunity to perform the songs live anywhere, which has been really strange in the last few months of the whole process, just doing everything from home.
I have to say, I'm sure many people who are listening feel for you the way you must have felt at some point, where you could have been going to LA, you know, attending the Grammys, the excitement that would have held, and the pandemic put a stop to all of that. Were you a little bit gutted, and what was it like just kind of watching the live stream?
Yeah, well, I absolutely love LA, and I definitely would have flown over if there had been a chance to do that, if it wasn't the pandemic. But you know what? Like, you know, everyone has different challenges at the moment, and, you know, the music industry and all the arts industry have been so rocked in the last year. So, you know, we were just glad to be able to mark it and celebrate it at home. And yeah, we all got dressed up in the house and we had a balloon and set up the live stream and just had a little celebration marking it. But yeah, hopefully in the future I'll get over for another one if there's ever another opportunity.
Please God, I have no doubt you'll be back at the Grammys again. So what was the ceremony like? And because obviously they had to handle it with social distancing and bearing the pandemic in mind, was it still as exciting as always, or how was it managed, and what did you think of it overall?
Yeah, so it was set up on two stages. So there was the live performance stage, and then there was the stage where they gave out the awards, which was kind of like a open air rooftop, it seemed to be. And yeah, it ran in the Los Angeles Convention Center, and it was just a very limited number of performers and nominees that were allowed in. And yeah, so it was really great. I suppose to me, what stood out maybe was Beyonce. She picked up the 28th Grammy win of her career, and she broke the record for the most Grammy wins ever by a female artist. So congratulations to her on that. And her own daughter, Blue Ivy, who's only 9 years old, won her first Grammy because she had a writing credit on Beyonce's music video, Brown Skin Girl. So that was a big night for them and their family. And another kind of standout moment, I suppose, was Harry Styles. He opened the show with a performance of Watermelon Sugar. I actually thought he did a fantastic job, and he also picked up Best Pop Solo Performance. And then I suppose I was really looking out for who won my categories. So Song of the Year went to her for her song I Can't Breathe, which actually she wrote in response to the Black Lives Matter protests in the US following that killing of George Floyd. And then my eyes were firmly set on who was going to win Best Contemporary Christian Music Performance or Song, and that actually went to Zach Williams and Dolly Parton for There Was Jesus, which I know is a staple on Spirit Radio's playlist. It's actually one of my favourite songs from the last year, so I was actually just absolutely thrilled that they won that.
And what about performances on the night?
Yeah, so there was a few performances, which was just lovely to see after the last year that we've had. Yeah, as I said, Harry Styles opened the show. I actually thought his performance was probably the best on the night. And then there were other performances from the likes of Haim to several others. Unfortunately, actually, Fontaines DC, which is an Irish band, they were nominated for Best Rock Album, but unfortunately they didn't manage to secure it in the end. So I was rooting for them as well. But yeah, it was super. I actually thought it was really well done. Like, usually sometimes those award ceremonies, they're very busy and they're kind of broken into bits between people trying to make kind of comedy speeches. And but I just felt that actually it just ran really fluently. It was kind of like humble in a way compared to usual. You know, it was a bit more understated. I think everyone just who was there felt it was a privilege to be there after the year that it's been. And yeah, I just thought it was super.
The Best of the Morning Show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Earlier on in the week, I was joined by Dr. Peter Taylor, who's a physicist, and we were discussing the reality that faith and science are not in conflict at all. But he started off talking about how this is a common misconception.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a misconception. And the funny thing is it's quite a modern misconception. The Big Bang was controversial in the 60s for precisely the opposite reason, because people knew that it had very strong theological implications. So that idea basically came to prominence by an accidental discovery by two scientists, Penzias and Wilson in the States, who basically discovered the leftover or the remnant radiation from the very early universe, from this kind of Big Bang event. And when they discovered that, it was very, very controversial. And many of the newspapers of that day were reporting on proof that God created the universe. And in fact, in Russian cosmologists and Russian scientists at that time were working very hard to try come up with alternate explanations for the Penzias-Wilson discovery, because they knew full well the theological implications of that discovery. And of course, their political leanings at the time meant that they were very invested in a strong atheistic Marxist worldview. So if this is controversial at all, it's because it's strongly suggestive of what you might say creation ex nihilo, or creation out of nothing. This is one of the strongest pieces of evidence.
It's one of the things that it backs up. Actually, interesting, so said George Lemaître was the first theoretical cosmologist ever nominated in 1954 for a Nobel Prize in Physics for his prediction of the expanding universe. So there's another fact about him. But bring it back to that, because that's really interesting, Peter, just how you're saying, no, actually, it was kind of atheistic scientists that were worried about the theological implications. So is that because, in simple terms, the Big Bang couldn't bang itself?
Yeah, essentially, yeah. The philosophical argument goes something like this. Everything that begins to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. So if you buy into the most common sense interpretation of the evidence, which is that the universe began to exist, then that conclusion is unavoidable. Like that's what we would call a logically valid argument. Again, I'll say it again. Everything that begins to exist must have a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause. And in fact, you can actually go even a little bit further than that, because the beginning, what we're calling the beginning here, is actually the beginning of space and time. We can say that the cause must be spaceless and timeless, because the universe is very vast. We can go a little bit further and say that the cause must have been very powerful. Because the universe involves personalities like us, we can say that the cause must have been personhood. So in fact, you can deduce even more than just the universe had a beginning. You can actually, I would say, almost provide some evidence for, I guess, a classical description of what we would call God.
And when you're explaining it there, Peter, just in terms of, is it that this God or whatever this thing was that caused the Big Bang is outside of space and time?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, because the beginning in this context means the beginning of space and time, and that's where space and time itself were created, then the cause has to be spaceless and timeless, because space and time doesn't exist until that point. So that's obviously a classical description of at least the monotheistic gods of Judaism and Christianity.
And when you're drilling down into the idea of the Big Bang from a scientific perspective, is that something that bolsters your faith, or does it make you question it more? And what's the kind of general view in the scientific community, or is it varied?
It's very much varied, yeah, because I think the the criticisms are more about trends, I think. You know, if you go back, to the earlier days, if you, like to read you a quote from Penzias himself, he says, so this is the Penzias who wins the Nobel Prize for detecting the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the strongest evidence for the beginning. He said, the best data we have are exactly what I would have predicted had I nothing to go on but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole. So that's kind of an amazing claim from a theoretical physicist. But I guess on the scientific side, a part of the problem is that these Big Bang models at their very earliest times are unreliable. So they're reliable very, very far back, but at the very earliest times, you'd have to take quantum effects into account, and we don't know how to do that yet. So many scientists are trying to come up with alternative theories that might present a different picture at the very, very earliest times. So, for example, one of the most common alternative models is not that the universe began at that point that we call the Big Bang, but rather that we're just in an expanding phase of a universe that contracts and expands and contracts and expands. But these models are problematic for a whole bunch of reasons. There's one avenue that looks like it might be promising. It's called loop quantum cosmology. I won't go into the technical details.
Yeah,
but
please break it down for us in an understandable way. So would that theory then take over from the Big Bang theory?
Well, you know, it's very early days. My personal opinion is that, so first of all of those alternative models are in the context of what we would call quantum gravity, and there is no theory of quantum gravity yet. So this is trying to get quantum mechanics to speak properly to Einstein's theory of general relativity, which describes gravity. And so this is the biggest problem, outstanding problem in theoretical physics, is how do we come up with a quantum theory of gravity? And the problem is that in order to accurately describe the very early universe, we really need both. We really need quantum theory and we need gravity. And because we don't have a satisfactory theory that deals with both, we're a little bit in the dark on those very earliest moments in our universe's history.
Do you think some of those things, Peter, are just for, you know, people like you, scientists, physicists, people interested in astrophysics, or does it go further for just ordinary people who have philosophical questions about life and the nature of existence?
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing is that, you know, most of science doesn't interact very strongly with theological or philosophical worldviews. But anytime you're dealing with the science of origins, there's a necessary overlap, right? So anytime if you're dealing with the science of the origin of man, or you're dealing with the science of the origin of the universe, or you're dealing with the science of the origin of information, those kinds of sciences necessarily have philosophical and theological implications. So there you will gather interest from all different perspectives, and the conclusions that you draw as a scientist in those arenas will probably be very strongly correlated with your worldview in the first place, because there's lots of different ways that one can interpret the data.
And what about that then for you, just thinking about that specifically, because your faith is obviously something that is important to you, and some people who share your faith might say, okay, the Big Bang Theory, does that mean things like the first chapter of Genesis is redundant?
No, not at all. I mean, that's exactly what that Penzias quote is telling us. You know, he's saying that, you know, had we nothing but the Bible, this is exactly what we would have guessed. I mean, all the Big Bang is really suggesting to us is that the universe had a beginning. And you have to understand that for almost all of history, civilizations have believed that the universe was eternal. And there were a few rare exceptions, of course, but you know, true non-Christian civilizations. But it was the Judeo-Christians who pretty much stood alone in their belief that the universe must have had a beginning, because that's exactly what Genesis says.
The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
From performing in the Riverdance to working on the front line during a global pandemic. That's the story my next guest shared with me earlier on in the week. Here's Dr. Maria Buffini.
So I suppose my full-time job now is obviously being a doctor, and then I was kind of called by Riverdance to see if I would be available for a few weeks last year they required more people just because, you know, they were playing such big venues because they were celebrating the 25th anniversary of the show. So luckily enough, I was able to make myself available, and I jumped at the chance to kind of get away for a bit of a change of scenery. So, you know, it was my full-time job really for, you know, 7 years, and I was a principal dancer, and then I stopped doing that full-time in 2012, and that was when I went back to do medicine, and I kind of worked for them intermittently, you know, always kind of kept a connection there and was able to, you know, do the Gaiety in the summer times and things like that, which was great. Last year just came up as a little bit of a pleasant surprise. So this time last year I had gone over to take part in the Radio City shows with Riverdance. So it was nearly, you know, it was literally just last week last year. And we played Radio City, and we had three shows done before really everything just changed in the States and here. And we were sent home early then, but it was lovely to be able to do a few shows there anyway.
It's like, Maria, you almost kind of got a taste of that change of scene, the excitement I would imagine of performing on stage, especially in a venue like Radio City. You must have been gutted when everything kind of kicked off and you realised, I got to go home now.
Yeah, well, to be honest, I felt more gutted for the people who were doing it full time and had looked forward to that week for literally their whole tour, you know, whereas I was kind of one of the lucky ones who was just getting to jump in anyway for the week, and I was only ever supposed to be there for the week and get home to my normal job again. So, I felt more sorry for them, to be honest. But yeah, obviously it was a pity that things were cut short that time.
So then did it just pretty much stop overnight? Was that just it? It was just, that's the end?
That was it, yeah. I mean, I think it was the third show, and literally after that it was just said, okay, there will be no more. I think all of Broadway shut down that night, if I remember correctly. And then there was a Riverdance tour going on in the UK at the same time, and I think they might have got a few more days out of it before then they were eventually sent home as well. So yeah, it's a real pity really for everyone who works in theatre and everything. Thing that it's just impossible to be up and running at the moment.
I know the arts world, like so many other aspects of our lives, has been really badly affected. But for you, Maria, then coming back to Ireland, were you straight into being back on the front line, or was there a transition period?
Yeah, so I mean, I was pretty much jam-packed, you know, literally just barely getting enough time off to be able to go and do the Riverdance stuff at all. So I was having a pretty hectic schedule at that time anyway. But unfortunately, when I did arrive home from New York, I wasn't feeling the best, and I was looking after elderly people at the time and was due back in on the Monday, and I just thought, oh my god, I better get a test, and it came back positive, so I had actually contracted COVID on my travels, and that was very early on for that. So, you know, it was even a lot of hassle to try and get the test. You know, I was kind of on the phone all day on the Sunday trying to sort it out, but eventually I think it was St. Patrick's Day last year that I got tested, and it unfortunately was positive, so I ended up having to do the isolation. And so it was a few weeks before I got back into work, and at the time then I was working in Connolly Hospital in Blanchardstown, and I mean, it was just such a change. I guess it had been 3 weeks at that stage that I hadn't been in, and it was just so different to go back into it because everything had just kicked off then. And it was a kind of, it was a really anxious time, you know, you didn't know what the day would bring, or if you'd be really overwhelmed, and you know, if we'd manage, you know. So there was a lot of work done in the background, kind of changing around shifts, making sure we had enough cover, trying to hire as many people as possible, but thankfully, you know, in the first wave we did manage, you know. But I suppose my own situation is that I am on the GP training, so I move around jobs quite a bit, and so I'm not working in Connolly anymore, I'm out in GP practice now. So So I suppose in some ways, you know, there are challenges in GP, but, you know, I haven't been directly on the front line in the hospitals for this third wave, which seems to have been much worse.
So you've been at the coalface in different ways, Maria. And how are you feeling now about the future? I suppose, given what you've experienced during the different waves, are you feeling hopeful, or what's your kind of gut on what's going to happen next?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, you know, I mean, there's so much information floating around out there, but hopefully, you know, this, I don't think anyone thought this third lockdown would go on as long as it is. You know, when you look back to Christmas now at this stage, and we're just getting into the nice weather now, thankfully, and that helps. But I mean, it's so hard on people to maintain this. But you just hope that will be worthwhile. And between that and the vaccination program getting up and running, you know, hopefully those things combined will just mean that we don't have to do this again. You know, fingers crossed.
Everyone's feeling that, Maria, for sure. So what's your kind of day-to-day like now?
So, I moved back into GP practice just in January. I had been moving around hospital posts up until then. So just kind of settled back into GP, and that was... it's much different now than it was before, and they have had to adapt in so many ways to try and maintain practice, but in much different conditions, you know. So it's a lot of, you know, you're still seeing people face to face, but it is a lot more kind of teleconsult stuff now, which, you know, wouldn't have really been heard of before COVID. A lot of it does work and is great for certain things. So I think there's a lot of positive changes that will probably come about after all of this. And, you know, I think the technology has come along a little bit to try and help make things a little bit more efficient. So I think there will be positives, and there'll definitely be aspects that came in because of COVID that will definitely be kept and that are useful. It's a challenging environment, and then, you know, it can be harder sometimes when you don't have a person sitting in front of you. It's a hard balance to try and maintain a good service along with safety and everything as well.
The best of the morning show with Wendy Grace on Spirit Radio.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.